where a starry stonewort was found recently during the starry trek that happened a few weeks ago. There are four new lakes with that invasive species. Lots going on at KAXC.org. Coming up in just a few moments, we're going to have a special edition of the Up North Report with Larissa Donovan. And coming up at 7:45, it's What We're Reading, a conversation with music journalist Chris DeVille. His debut book is A Definitive History of Indie Rock. It's called Such Great Hikes. KAXC producer Andrew DeZingo will join Chris for that conversation. Taking a look at temperatures right now, 38 in Park Rapids, 41 in Aiken, 42 in Bemidji, and Hibbing, Grand Rapids, and Brainerd all at 44 degrees. Sunny today with highs in the mid to upper 60s, winds from the northwest 5 to 15. Tonight, partly cloudy, lows 41 to 45, and for tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs 71 to 76. And looking ahead to Wednesday, mostly sunny, highs 75 to 80. The KAXC Newsroom has created a map of northern Minnesota farmers markets throughout our region, from places like Park Rapids to Palo, Talmoon to Reamer, Black Duck to Crosby. Most markets run through September or October. You can find the map at KAXC.org.
For KAXC News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. The data center construction boom remains on Minnesota's radar with new environmental protections in place, but two cities face lawsuits with claims they are falling short in getting a read on how much future projects would drain natural resources. The Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy this week took legal action against the cities of Lakeville and North Mankato, arguing local leaders did not follow state law under the environmental review process when advancing projects. Evan Mulholland, staff attorney at the center, says the evaluations left a lot to be desired.
We don't know how much water they're going to use. For energy, we don't know where the energy is going to come from. We don't know whether they're going to have contracts for clean energy, for carbon-free energy or not. All of these things are just missing.
He pointed out the public is also left in the dark about potential noise when equipment is running to store digital data and keep computing machines cool. This spring, state lawmakers extended tax breaks to lure more centers, along with tougher environmental regulations. Advocates said the safeguards are a good step, but not enough. When reached for comment, North Mankato officials say they led an open review process. Data centers are known for massive water consumption and pushing energy demand higher. In some cases, developers request to implement backup diesel generators, potentially adding to their carbon footprint. Mulholland stressed they are not against such facilities, recognizing the need to accommodate digital use in everyday life. He emphasized they are seeking transparency when measuring the environmental impact.
Some of these cities have signed non-disclosure agreements with the developer, and it's becoming an obstacle for the public to understand what it is being proposed to be built.
North Mankato officials said they were looking at different types of development, prompting a broad review without specific details. But the lawsuit contended city staff used the term data center in emails when discussing the matter. The plaintiffs are requesting a stop to project activity, including permitting, until a more detailed environmental assessment is done. It's a burden many Minnesota parents can relate to, struggling to afford childcare or finding an open slot. Now, a decades-old idea to create equal access around the country is getting another look. The U.S. childcare system is often described as broken, with states and local governments pursuing a patchwork of solutions, along with limited federal subsidies for low-income households. The nonprofit think tank, the Roosevelt Institute, led a new report calling for a, quote, public option approach with stronger federal investments to close gaps. Lena Billick, a program manager for the Institute, said despite the urgency, attempts to solve this crisis for working parents have been uneven at best.
We keep tinkering around the edges, but, you know, what we really need is for childcare to be a public good.
The author suggested, like public schools, there should be a universal network of care sites to guarantee free slots without means testing. Instead of subsidies and tax credits, they called for a big boost in federal aid for providers so they can expand and hire staff and keep costs down. The policy push traces back to the 1970s, but has faced political resistance along the way. On average, childcare costs account for nearly 19% of a Minnesota family's income. While this idea still has opponents, elected leaders from all parties have filed bipartisan bills in response to the child care shortage. The Economic Security Project is a partner in the report. Taylor Joe Eisenberg, executive director of the nonprofit Economic Security Project, is among those who see it as an infrastructure investment to help the economy by keeping parents in the workforce.
And so I think understanding these as tools, not just to meet the needs of families right now, but as a kind of foundation of a healthy, dynamic economy and country is a really important part of the story.
Some of the national pushback against a universal system suggests it would erode the quality of care. Billick countered one of their recommendations strongly advises against provisions like deregulation.
A trend around the country is sort of changing adult to child ratio rules to deal with the shortage of staff. Now, that might sound okay, but then you picture a room, we're talking literal babies or infants that need care, and you need a lot of adults for that.
Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for these stories. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
You can hear the latest edition of the Up North Report today at 5:30 during All Things Considered here on KAXE. Also, lots of local stories right now at our website, kaxe.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show. Coming up at 7:20, we'll have Events Up North, a closer look at what's going on throughout the region this week. Support comes from Brainstorm Bakery, headquarters of Crapola, with four flavors of granola handcrafted at the bakery on East Sheridan Street in Ely. Online ordering available and more at brainstormbakery.com. And we thank the Watermark Art Center in downtown Bemidji with exhibits, classes, and handcrafted original art made by regional artists found in their shop 505. The center is accessible and open to the public, watermarkartcenter.org. Taking a look at our weather today, it should be sunny, highs in the mid to upper 60s, winds from the northwest 5 to 15, partly cloudy overnight, lows 41 to 45, and mostly sunny tomorrow, highs 71 to 76. You could answer our question of the week. What were your favorite books to read as a child? Text in 218-326-1234. We continue with Morning Edition here on People Powered KAXE.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
Jeremy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The Trump administration is using law enforcement to investigate one of the president's critics. The FBI searched the home and office of John Bolton on Friday.
He's Trump's former national security advisor, now a guest on programs including this one, where he is given an independent view. The FBI move seized attention on the same day the Justice Department acted in another case where the president has an interest. Officials released their interview with Ghislaine Maxwell. She's the longtime accomplice of convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein and is now speaking up for Trump. In a moment, we hear from a former White House attorney on all this. We begin with the facts.
NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas is here. So, Ryan, let's start with the Maxwell interview. Why did the department want to talk to her?
So, first off, the department released what it says is the full transcript and audio of Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche's interview last month in Florida with Maxwell, where she's serving her prison sentence. Blanche, who, it's important to note, previously served as President Trump's personal attorney, took this unusual step because the Justice Department and the administration more broadly has been under a lot of fire for how it's handled the Epstein matter. It promised transparency only to then say that no more documents would be made public. That caused a public backlash, including from some MAGA faithful. So the administration has been scrambling to contain that fallout.
So what did she have to say?
Well, she was asked about many of the rich and powerful people who have been associated over the years with Epstein. That includes, of course, President Trump, who was friends with Epstein for years before they had a falling out. Maxwell was very complimentary of Trump. She told Blanche that she liked him, that he was always a gentleman. She also said that she never saw any man do anything inappropriate with a woman of any age while with Epstein.
Yeah, she was also convicted of helping Epstein sexually exploit underage girls. So how credible is she?
Right. She is currently serving a 20-year prison sentence, in fact, for helping Epstein recruit, groom, and sexually exploit girls as young as 14. So a jury heard evidence at trial of her role in that and found her guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Federal prosecutors also charged her at one point with perjury for allegedly lying in a deposition about her actions with Epstein. So the Justice Department itself has previously said that she's not credible. Now, Maxwell's attorney, David Marcus, said in a statement after this interview was released that Maxwell's innocent, that she told the truth. But it's important to point out again that Maxwell is serving a long prison sentence. She would like some sort of clemency, whether a reduction in sentence or a pardon. And of course, President Trump is the only man with the power to deliver that. I'll also note that shortly after Maxwell's interview with Blanche, she was moved from a federal prison in Florida to a minimum security prison camp in Texas.
All right. Now let's turn now to John Bolton, the search of John Bolton's home and office. Is this part of Trump's campaign, maybe, of vengeance against perceived political enemies?
Well, look, Trump said on Friday that he didn't know anything about it. His vice president, J.D. Vance, told NBC News that Bolton was not targeted because he's a critic of the president. We know that this investigation relates to classified documents, but we don't know much more at this point. But look, there is certainly a growing list of people whom the president considers political enemies who are facing Justice Department investigations. California Senator Adam Schiff, New York Attorney General Letitia James are two of them. The department also has reportedly taken steps to investigate actions around the Obama-era intelligence that led to the Russia investigation into Trump's 2016 campaign, which, of course, is a main grievance of Trump's. The department's also fired prosecutors who worked on the investigations into Trump himself or January 6th Capitol riot cases. All of these actions certainly fit into the vision that Trump spelled out during the campaign of seeking vengeance on his perceived enemies.
That's NPR's Ryan Lucas. Ryan, thank you.
Thank you.
Our White House correspondent Tamara Keith made an observation over the weekend. The president campaigned in 2024 while promising retribution for his enemies. And then when criticized, he clarified that retribution just meant his success. Once inaugurated, Tam observes Trump's retribution turned out to mean retribution.
So now, as the chief law enforcement officer in our country, I will insist upon and demand full and complete accountability for the wrongs and abuses that have occurred.
That's Trump speaking earlier this year. Now, we just heard of investigations of multiple Trump critics, including John Bolton. Over the weekend, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie commented on ABC about the president's use of the Justice Department. And afterward, Trump said on social media that perhaps we should start investigating Chris Christie. We have Ty Cobb on the line. He was a White House attorney in Trump's first term, managing the White House response to special counsel Robert Mueller's probe into allegations of Russian election interference. Mr. Cobb, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Steve.
What did you think about when you heard of the FBI search of John Bolton's house and office?
Well, I went down and locked my door.
Well, okay, so you're ready for a knock. I think you're saying that it seems like even somebody who worked for the president is not safe in this situation.
I think anybody that's critical of the president, has justifiable paranoia at this stage of the game. But, I think it's important on the Bolton thing to not overreact. There is certainly, retribution involved. There's certainly an abandonment of traditional norms at the Justice Department in going back and doing this, typically in the situation where somebody has written a book that gets close to the line or goes over the line on classified information. There are there's anxiety, there's name calling, there's a bunch of bad press, but it's rare, if ever, that anybody gets prosecuted under those circumstances because the pre-review process is heavily weighted against classified information
right.
Getting out. And in Bolton's situation, he did submit his manuscript for review. They didn't want to publish it, so he had to sue to enforce the process. And ultimately, the release of his book was authorized by a federal court.
Now, you're giving us a lot of background here. Bolton did write a very critical memoir. I suppose, to be fair, we don't know what the FBI found or might find. We might find that there was a classified document or something in there, but it sounds like you're skeptical of that possibility.
Well, I do think it's certainly possible that they'll find documents that they insist are classified. Whether, in fact, at this stage of the game, that classification is is real or not would have to be litigated. But I think in the Bolton situation, you know, you do have a federal judge finding in his circumstances that he likely did disclose classified information. That's part of the public record. So there must have been enough in the affidavit, you know, seeking the search warrant that supported a magistrate judge issuing the warrant for probable cause. We'll see that affidavit at some point, assuming that Bolton gets charged. I'm not sure he will be charged.
Mm-hmm.
I differ from others on those who say that he's certain to be indicted. I think...
You think this is a non-serious search, then?
I think it could have been. It certainly is the type of thing that, you know, historically would have been handled by subpoenas and discussions with attorneys, because keep in mind, this is something that was litigated extensively 5 years ago.
Now, as I understand it, the White House has denied that they directed this search of John Bolton, but the White House has absolutely asserted the president's authority to direct law enforcement. We just heard the tape. We heard the president's own words. He referred to himself as the chief law enforcement officer in our country. There was a guy who was the acting U.S. attorney in Washington, D.C. for a while who referred to himself and the people in his office as President Trump's lawyers, not lawyers for the United States, but President Trump. Is it appropriate for a president to be directing investigations?
So that's an excellent question, and absolutely not. I mean, and you know, that's the sea change that people are sort of ignoring here. This is no longer a Justice Department, you know, with independent thinkers, you know, acting ethically. These people are so totally devoted to Trump and his campaign of vengeance. And, you know, they made that clear when they welcomed him into the Great Hall and Pam Bondi, you know, declared the fealty of the department to the president as opposed to the Constitution, which is actually what their oath is for. Same thing at the FBI. You know, the FBI is being hollowed out. Experienced senior decision makers, you know, who have years of experience, again, acting ethically without partisan objectives, have been removed. They've been replaced by loyalists, and now they're, you know, gutting the qualifications of the agents, further demeaning the agency, abandoning the college degree requirement. You know, soon it'll be like Mayberry RFD.
Interesting observation. It used to be, it has been, that you have to be highly educated to be in the FBI. I want to ask about the argument that is made here, though. The administration draws a very bold line, and they essentially say the president is elected, everybody else is not elected, and if they defy the president in any way, they're the deep state, they're extra constitutional, they're another branch of government, that it's all wrong. When I study this, though, when I listen to people who've worked in the Justice Department and study the history, I realize there's usually actually some ambiguity. Yes, a president is in charge of the Justice Department, but it's often said that an ethical attorney general would refuse to do inappropriate things. I believe that's the position of William Barr, Trump's former attorney general. And when I go back in the 19th century, I find presidents who told prosecutors to do things and they just said no. Is that ambiguity supposed to be part of the system, very briefly?
You know, so yeah, so it shouldn't be ambiguous at all. You know, the loyalty there is supposed to be to the Constitution, not to the president. Historically, mm-hmm. You don't have presidents dictating criminal prosecutions. You know, this is a highly unusual thing and part of the authoritarian creep of Trump's narcissism.
Ty Cobb was special counsel in the first Trump White House. Thanks for joining us this morning, sir. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Take care. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to your public radio station, which brings you Morning Edition. NPR News is broadcast across this country on local stations, including this one. And here's the way it works. Each local station is in the community. It is run by people from this community, and it is supported by the people who use it. And that's the way that it ought to be. So thanks for listening. This is NPR News.
It's 7:19. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Just a few moments, we'll have Events Up North, a closer look at the events happening throughout the region this week. We do want to let you know that the Itasca County Family YMCA will be closed for plumbing work today through Wednesday. Their outdoor courts will still be available. Support for KAXE comes from Thrive Up North, sharing the stories of a welcoming community of people who've chosen to make Itasca County their new home, promoting all the area has to offer, including natural amenities and jobs in healthcare, manufacturing, and more. Offering an incentive package to help with your move to the area. Learn more at thriveupnorth.com. We also thank Beltrami Electric, a Touchstone Energy cooperative with a mission to provide safe, affordable, reliable electric service. Beltrami Electric Cooperative, connecting communities and powering life in northern Minnesota for more than 80 years. It is time for Events Up North. We'll look at some of the events happening across northern Minnesota this week. Brainerd Women of Today invite all ages to Chalk the Block this morning from 9:30 to 11. Spread positivity by drawing or writing uplifting messages on Laurel Street. Meet at Passport Restaurant. And the Central Lakes College Ag and Energy Research Center has its annual field day this Friday, August 29th. From 9 to 3 at their site in Staples. It's a day of hands-on demonstrations, education sessions, local food, and more. You can find a schedule at clcagandenergy.org/events. And you can learn all about bats at the Saxon Bog this Saturday, August 30th from 5:30 to 9 p.m. There will be both indoor and outdoor portions of this presentation. Registration is required. Learn more at saxzim.org/events. And the Friends of Lake Bemidji State Park have a pancake breakfast this Sunday, August 31st from 8 to 10 at the park's dining hall. You can bring your own plates and utensils to help the environment. And finally, Native American Music and Arts Festival is this Sunday, August 31st, 10 to 5 at the Mille Lacs Indian Museum and Trading Post near Onamia. There will be artists, demonstrations, live music, and food trucks. Events Up North is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota. If you have events to share with our listeners, email us, psa@kaxe.org, and you can look for Events Up North at kaxe.org every week. And, of course, coming up, it's just a week from this Saturday. Saturday, September 6th, it's Grand Rapids River Fest right here next door to KAXE at the Grand Rapids Area Library Amphitheater. Find tickets, more information, grandrapidsriverfest.com. Our lineup features Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Again, grandrapidsriverfest.com. We're going to hear some music now from Margot Price, who will be performing there. This is from the 2023 album Strays, It's Change of Heart.
One of these days, you're gonna wake up older with a hole in your pocket and a blade on your shoulder. Well, if you break both your legs, oh, don't come running to me. I've had a change of heart. I've had a change of heart. Worry about the war. Nobody's winning. Don't worry about the rain. It's only beginning. I never loved you and I always will. I had a change of heart. Had a change of heart. Run from danger, straight
change of heart. I had a change of heart. A wanted child with an absent mother. All protection like an older brother. Remember forgetting all the words that you said. I had a change of heart. I had a change of heart.
That is Margot Price. See her live in Grand Rapids Saturday, September 6th as part of Grand Rapids River Fest. She'll be joined by Alan Sparhawk, Jeremy Albino, and Courtney Barnett. Tickets and more information at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. It is 7:27. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, continuing their Martini Monday music series with Grand Rapids musician Greg Kaser performing today from 5 to 8. More info on the music series at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. We also thank Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. Let's take a look at our current temperatures. It is a cool morning out there. Some frost advisories were out there, and 38 degrees in Park Rapids, 41 in Aiken, 42 in Bemidji, 44 in Hibbing, Grand Rapids, and Brainerd. For today, we can expect sunny skies with highs in the mid to upper 60s, winds from the northwest 5 to 15, partly cloudy overnight, lows 41 to 45, and tomorrow mostly sunny, highs 71 to 76, lows on Tuesday night in the low 50s, and for Wednesday mostly sunny and warmer, highs 75 to 80, slight chance of rain in the afternoon. Answer our question of the week. What were your favorite books to read as a child? Text in 218-326-1234.
In the past, we knew more about our neighbors. I'm Heidi Holton, and KEXE provides that. We get to know the people that live in northern Minnesota, like Kathy Davies on What's for Breakfast.
Well, truly, every day I wake up with you guys, and so there's socialization. And I love the local news. That interview with Amy Klobuchar this morning was wonderful. I am so supportive of finding out what's going on with all the tribal stations, and I care about the Canadian wildfires. I love to hear about everything that's local. You know, I've been to Riverfest, and that was fantastic. I listen to and support KAXE because you guys are what it's all about up here.
When you donate to KEXE, you're supporting your local community. Help us out now during this crisis of the defunding of public media from the federal government. Thank you for being there for KEXC. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
It is 7:29. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at about 7:45, what we're reading today, a conversation between Andrew DeZingle and Chris DeVille. Chris has written a book called Such Great Heights. It's a definitive history of indie rock. Coming up at 8:10, we're going to learn more about literacy and going back to school in the Grand Rapids Area School District, ISD 318. We'll talk with Superintendent Matt Gross and the district's lead literacy person, Carol Kopp. And coming up at 9 o'clock, I'm sticking around. I'll be your host for Headwaters. It is Monday, which means we've got a request line theme, and I want to hear your suggestions about songs about reading and writing. Text in 218-326-1234. Also, our question of the week is all about books that you like to read as a kid. Love to hear those suggestions. 218-326-1234. Text in. Right now, it is time for best wishes. We're going to do our best to wish friends and neighbors happy birthday, happy anniversary. We will start with yesterday, August 24th. Happy 12th anniversary to Cindy Davis and Kathy Peter from Minneapolis. Gary and Dorothy Brusty, happy 53rd anniversary to you in Bemidji. Casey and Shara Dabrowski, happy 12th anniversary in Warba. Chloe Marone turned 21 yesterday from Brainerd, going back to school at the U of M. And Marvin Hayatala, 85 years old in Grand Rapids. Kathleen McMurray, happy 70th in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania. And Kathy Edmonds celebrated a birthday yesterday in Bemidji. Anya Hogan turned 36 in Baxter. And Fred Carlish, happy 68th to you in Hackensack. And today is August 25th. Happy 47th anniversary to David and Susan Lick from Grand Rapids. Dave and Marilyn Rhoda, happy 59th in Grand Rapids. Also, Nancy Mike Johnson and Sam Johnson celebrating 46 years in Grand Rapids. Birthdays for today, Kevin Anderson, happy birthday to you in St. Paul. Cindy Downing celebrating in Cohasset. Steve Quam, happy 78th in St. Paul. And Paul Morin, happy 59th. And Chanel Hartwell having a birthday today in Solway. Our best wishes to you all. If you do have birthday or anniversary greetings to share with us, please text in 218-326-1234. If you let us know a day or two in advance, we can get it on our best wishes list. Otherwise, we can also make those last minute additions. So we are going to hear some music, some new music. This is a band called Watch House. The song we're going to hear is called Rituals.
Get to thinking that I'm doing well. Everything I want just seems to fall in place. Cause I've been working hard. I can't recall the reasons for my rituals. I'm so spiritual, I just exist. I send my love to you.
wish I remembered all my neighbors' names. Someday I'll knock on every door. Instead I sit here wondering at the passersby, why no one drops in anymore, unannounced. So I sing lonesome songs, but still it's nice to see you as you're strolling by. Days to come spread across your face. Oh, the race certainly has called.
That is the band Watch House with the title track to an album that came out earlier this summer called Rituals, here on the Monday Morning Show on KAXC. It is 7:37. Coming up in a few minutes, we're going to have our daily dose of phenology and then what we're reading today with Andrew DeZingle, talking with Chris DeVille about his debut book, Such Great Heights. It's a definitive history of indie rock. Coming up just after 8 o'clock, we're going to talk about literacy and going back to school with some folks from the Grand Rapids Area School District, Superintendent Matt Gross and Carol Kopp. Remember, we want to hear your song suggestions on reading and writing for our request line coming up at 10:30 today during Headwaters. Text in 218-326-1234.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
Anime Martinez. Online dating has been around for decades, and some people are just not fans. So they're returning to the ancient technique of looking for potential partners in person. WPR's Anna Marianni recently attended a singles mixer in Madison, Wisconsin, and has this report.
It's just before 6 p.m., and 16 single people are arriving at a cocktail bar in Madison, Wisconsin. They range in age from their early 20s to early 40s, and there's no hiding behind a photo here. That's something 24-year-old Tegan Davis says definitely can happen with a dating app.
And it can be really hard, too, when you meet someone that isn't like their profile shows you, right? Because you're very much curating how you want to appear to the world.
Davis is sitting with her friend, 26-year-old Ellie Braun. They're artists, educators, and a few months ago, they were talking about the movie Ghost, which has this romantic scene where Patrick Swayze and Demi Moore spin a vase on a pottery wheel.
Whoa, my love.
Unlike the movie, this pottery event is G-rated, since the two friends decided to create a much tamer singles gathering where people meet each other while painting ceramic mugs.
Tegan and I have both talked about with our friends how difficult like meeting people in person is, and on like dating apps. So I think there's definitely like a desire for people to have these kinds of events where, like, you know, going into it that if you talk to someone, they're going to be single, instead of like trying to put yourself out there at a bar where you don't know what someone's situation is.
Starting here probably in the next 5-10 minutes.
26-year-old star Welk Schwartz, rocking red hair and winged eyeliner, says she came to the event looking for a change.
Something like this, you know, you see people as people. You don't see them as something, like, on your screen.
She says dating apps can feel almost inhumane. There's a lack of empathy. That's not the case here.
There's, like, more of an intention here. It's like you're actually trying to meet people.
So she chats at a table with four others while she paints her cats on a mug. Across the room, 24-year-old Ben Goss is adding a cow to his mug. He says he just needs more experience.
I haven't really gone on many dates. I've gone on a date with a friend. That's it, basically.
Goss says he's ultimately looking for a relationship, but believes dating apps limit his chances.
They're able to, through algorithms, choose who you see and who sees you.
Dating apps do work for some people, but a 2023 Pew Research Center survey found a third of young adults said online dating made finding a long-term partner harder. Catalina Toma, a University of Wisconsin-Madison communication science professor, found people could be feeling fatigued from choice overload.
It creates a mentality that the right person or the ideal person is still out there and I just need to search more.
And at the pottery event, 42-year-old Aaron Rosted said he showed up because he's found in-person connections can't be replicated by using an app. Plus, he says the pottery activity makes for a good conversation starter.
Having something to do with your hands or like talk about what you're doing as opposed to just being like,
hey, do you come here often?
At the end of the night, people were not rushing home together, but many say they'll be back for future mixers because they like the old-fashioned way of getting to know each other. For NPR News, I'm Anna Marie Yanni in Madison, Wisconsin.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Ian Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inske.
I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks for listening to KAXE's Monday Morning Show. It is 7:41. In just a moment, our daily dose of phonology. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's Apple Service Center in Bemidji and Grand Rapids, offering both in-warranty and out-of-warranty service on Apple products and computer repair. More at paulbunyan.net. We also thank ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. Weather for today, sunny, highs in the mid to upper 60s, northwest winds 5 to 15, partly cloudy tonight, lows 41 to 45, mostly sunny tomorrow with highs 71 to 76, lows tomorrow night in the low 50s, and for Wednesday, mostly sunny, highs 75 to 80, just a slight chance of rain in the afternoon. Support for KAXE comes from Itasca County Health and Human Services hosting the 17th Annual Community Connect Thursday, September 18th from 11 to 3 at Yanmar Arena in Grand Rapids, featuring over 50 social service agencies providing info on housing, energy, county assistance, and more. All are welcome. Phonology is the rhythmic biological nature of events as they relate to climate. It is time for our Daily Dose with John Latimer.
On today's date, August 25th, 1992, I notice the first jack-in-the-pulpit berries are ripe. Bright red berries in a thick column. The leaves are fading fast, kind of drooping, but the berries are exquisite. Usually about this time of year, I pick those same berries and break them off of the little pod and cast them about, help them get a start. Help them to grow into new jack-in-the-pulpit plants. I've got quite a patch now. The interesting thing about jack-in-the-pulpit is that the more robust and vigorous they are, the more apt they are to be female. And conversely, when they are weakened and in a poor state, they may become male. And they can switch back and forth between male and female each year as their conditions dictate. But this time of year, those bright red berries are certainly easy to spot, and as you break them off of the structure underneath, note the color of the structure. The few times that I have done this, the structure underneath has been a lovely purple. Enjoy, and don't eat the berries. They're full of a dangerous chemical called calcium oxalate. It won't kill you, but you'll be ever so sorry if you try to eat one.
That is our daily phenology. You can tune in tomorrow morning, 7:20, for John Latimer's latest observations. Also, we want to hear from you. What have you been observing? You can always email us, comments@kaxc.org, or text us, 218-326-1234. What we're reading is our show all about books, produced by our staff librarian, Tammy Bobrowski. Today we'll hear a conversation about the new definitive history of indie rock. From Iron and Wine and Death Cab for Cutie to Phoebe Bridgers and St. Vincent, the book is called Such Great Heights. Author and music journalist Chris DeVille joins KAXE producer Andrew DeZingle to talk about this book.
As we said goodbye to the 1900s and decades of top 40s radio hits, the grunge and alt-rock scene soon gave way to the future of music. A rising popularity and commercialization of indie rock, bands like Death Cab for Cutie, The National, MGMT, Best Coast, The Postal Service, and many, many more, exploded onto the music scene. In his new book, Chris DeVille, music journalist and managing editor at Stereo Gum, writes of his own experience of mining for new music on the internet in the early 2000s. He writes, "I didn't realize it then, but this was a paradigm shift. I drilled down into a world that existed just beneath the mainstream, into a subculture that would transform the way I approached music for better and for worse. Life would never be the same again. I had discovered indie rock." In this What We're Reading conversation, we'll hear more from Chris. His new book is called Such Great Heights, The Complete Cultural History of the Indie Rock Explosion. It's a definitive history of how the genre shifted the musical landscape and shaped a generation. Our own indie music expert, KAXE producer Andrew DeZingle, had the opportunity to talk with Chris about his new book.
Why did it seem now was a good time to write about that certain period of the indie rock boom era?
It felt like the timing was right, partially because we had some distance from it. And also, I felt like we were starting to see some historical books about that era, like notably Meet Me in the Bathroom is the oral history of New York during the time of the Strokes and Yeah, Yeah, Yeahs and Interpol and all that. And so we're starting to see that moment, you know, kind of canonized in books, but I have not seen as much about the way that that rippled into the 2010s. And I found that early 2010s moment to be really fascinating, one where, you know, a lot of the changes that happened in indie music in the 2000s really kind of came home to roost. Yeah, that's when I started working at Stereo Gum as well, was 2013. And I was like, at that point in time, all of the, you know, you had all these indie pop stars that were starting to pop up and all of the kind of like new buzzy bands were like trying to be pop artists or R&B or like, you know, incorporate hip hop production techniques or this or that. And it was like anything except just like scraggly old like Pavement style indie rock was cool at that time. And so I think it was just like a cultural moment that hadn't really been documented in a book. It felt like it was documented in blog posts and social media posts and old dead links that you have to find on the Wayback Machine and message boards and stuff. And so, yeah, it felt like it would be cool to sort of present that moment culturally in a more permanent document.
So, yeah, I was wondering about that with the research for this book, where so much of like what was happening was on blogs and stuff like that, people sharing that information. Like, of course, Pitchfork and Stereo Gum are still around, so you would have access to that. But even then, Pitchfork has deleted some of their reviews from the past. So with finding these dead links and stuff, how do you even know where to look for all this?
Some of it was like, oh, I remember there was an article about this, and so I'm going to go see what I can Google. Some of it is just the classic, like following the links at the bottom of Wikipedia pages and seeing if they have working links within those links. There was checking books out from the library. Greg Kot was really ahead of the curve on this stuff, and he wrote his book Wired about how the internet changed music, basically. That came out in 2009, I think. And so, you know, there were a few other books that I read that proved to be like sort of source texts. But yeah, there's a lot of just kind of clicking around, putting certain search terms together, or like, you know, if you're able to find an old social media post and see what the responses were to that post. But that's another thing that where they get deleted a lot. Or like, I was talking about Best Coast's Twitter account in the book, and it's like, she's changed her handle since then. I think she's more active on Substack than on Twitter at this point. So there was a lot of just kind of like archaeology of the internet happening.
One thing I like that you point out in the book is how the internet was indie rock's best friend, but also led to its downfall. Was that something you had already thought about before going into the book, or was it something that you kind of realized while writing the book?
I think I realized it while I was mapping out the chapters, you know, and I was working on the book proposal. I had to figure out, like, you know, what are the sort of key moments in this story? How can I group these events that I remember together into coherent chunks? And it became really clear when I was mapping it out that I needed a 2000s tech chapter to talk about piracy and iTunes and MySpace and just everything that happened then, but that there would be a need for another tech chapter at the end. The final chapter really was supposed to be two chapters and they got smushed together, but like there is an aspect of the final chapter that gets into Spotify and the rise of social media and the impact that that had on blogs. So yeah, I don't think I had fully comprehended how much it was going to be a tech oriented book until I started mapping it out. And then it was like, oh yeah, this really is in a lot of ways the story of the evolution of the internet over the last couple of decades. And that's part of the way that I tried to connect it to people's lives. Like, even if you're not a person who was listening to a lot of Arcade Fire and TV on the radio, you're a person who was using AOL Instant Messenger probably, and then moved on to using MySpace and Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, and eventually started getting your music off of Spotify or Apple Music. Like, those are things that have touched many, many people's lives, you know, far beyond the actual music that's getting covered here.
Going through each chapter, I always think about this because I'm like, man, music's just doesn't feel the same as it did like 10 years ago. And I'm like, am I just doing that because I was in my late teens, early 20s when that was happening? I'm just like thinking about my youth. But reading through your book, it seemed like there was monumental albums coming out all the time, where now it seems like they're just, is it because there just isn't that amount of websites to hype these albums anymore? Or do you think it is something that has changed in music where there just isn't that drive to make that their pet sounds kind of thing?
There are a few different elements to that. I feel that too. Like, I mean, obviously I'm listening to a bunch of new albums every week, and there are some every year that come out that I'm really excited about. So I don't ever feel like there's such a thing as a bad year for music, but I do relate to what you're saying about how, like, back then it felt like there were just landmark albums coming out all the time. And I think there is something to your thought about how the media has kind of degraded. There used to be this huge media infrastructure around music in general and indie music specifically. And obviously, like, that still exists to some extent, but there was like a whole pipeline that existed, and it was possible to really build ahead of steam through coverage. So yeah, I think there's something to that. I think, you know, the album. There's always the classic debate about the album as an art form and is it dying? Like, it's not dying, but like, it does seem like we're in a more singles oriented space at this time. And then there's just like, I mean, I'm just turned 42. I don't know exactly how old you are, but like, there's probably an aspect of like, when you're young, it just feels differently. And people who are half my age right now, who just turned 21, I imagine that the music that they're discovering, the new artists that are kind of on the vanguard right now, it feels more like resounding and meaningful to them. You know, when you're older, you can kind of see how everything repeats and it's like, oh, that's not so different than what came before. Or maybe it's like a new genre evolution that like feels a little bit outside of our grasp. So there's that aspect of it too. And I guess there's one more thing that I would say about that. We're at this time when old music is new music in some ways. Like, you know, there was the Kate Bush situation when her song was in Stranger Things a few years ago, and then it ended up being like this huge chart hit, even though it was decades old. With TikTok and even with streaming services, it seems like younger generations are having less of a distinction between new music and old music. And as long as it's, you know, new to them, it can be exciting. So yeah, there's so much to say about that subject, but I think that the ideas that you were putting forward about it are definitely resonant.
Any artists that you wanted to talk about but couldn't fit in the book?
Oh man, my editor, pretty much every chapter, there would be a point in the chapter where she would be like, you're just listing off bands now. Like you can probably lose these paragraphs or like this whole page kind of going off on a tangent. And it was because I wanted it to be like, don't forget this band, this band, this band, and this band was important at that time too. And I wanted to be really completist about it, but it was like, we have to be telling a story and like zooming out for the big picture, and not every single band can be mentioned in like a completist kind of way. If you do, then it just ends up being like a list of band names or like, you know, Wikipedia or something. So yeah, my editor was very wise about what to cut. And I think everybody who I really wanted to make sure they got in the book, I made sure that they got in the book. But there was plenty of skipping over of stuff where I was like, oh, I would have really liked to have had that. But the things that I felt like was like, I can't tell this story without these bands, they're in there.
One thing I love that you included in the book was Grimes trying to sail down the Mississippi with her boyfriend or whatever, because that actually happened here in Bemidji. And there was people in that still to this day in town saying like, did you know Grimes came to town before she became famous and stuff like that? So it's a local legend here now.
Yeah, I was happy to include that. It felt, you know, I feel like that's part of her lore, her origin story. There's plenty of my own local Ohio stuff that made its way into the book just because I'm an Ohio person, but I was glad to be able to include some of your Minnesota lore.
Was there anything else in the book that maybe that you forgot had happened? And then during your research, I'm like, oh, that's right, that did happen.
Oh, that happened so many times, but at this point, it's all blurred together for me. It was very fun. It was definitely a trip down memory lane for me. So like, I think I was trying to say that even if somebody wasn't like the hugest indie fan, if they're of the right age, they will probably relate to this book. But for the people who were really tapped in, who were reading the blogs and, you know, checking Pitchfork scores and getting really obsessed with indie rock at this time, I think there's going to be a lot of those moments for those readers, like sort of these kind of flashback moments that something gets activated within your memory that you forgot was even there. That's what I hope happens as people read it.
That was our What We're Reading conversation with author and music journalist Chris DeVille. The book is called Such Great Heights. You can tell us about a book you've been enjoying over on our What We're Reading Facebook page, or text us 218-326-1234. Would also love to hear about your favorite childhood books. That is our question of the week. Text us 218-326-1234. Also today, request line is songs about reading and writing. Text in your suggestions for that.